Welcome to The Rate Debate, a lively discussion from the champions of Australian fixed income, featuring Darren Langer and Chris Rands from Nikko Asset Management.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the final episode of The Rate Debate for 2020. I'm Darren Langer, Head of Australian Fixed Income at Nikko Asset Management, and joining me is my co-portfolio manager, Chris Rands.
Hello, everyone.
Well, what a year it's been. It's certainly been a year I don't think any of us will forget anytime soon. And it's probably a year that we never expected to see reasonable outcomes for fixed income. But it ended up being quite a good year, even with ultra low rates, COVID-19 and economies in lockdown and things like that. We've seen RBA do policy measures that we could never have once thought that they would ever entertain. So it's been quite a full-on year. Today was probably what he expected. The RBA sat on its hands and didn't do anything after their meeting back in the previous month in November. We weren't really expecting them to do a lot more because they did so much then. So, Chris, looking back over the year, what do you think the highlights of 2020 were?
From a portfolio positioning perspective or the economy?
Of course.
I think the biggest thing that really, I guess, happened this year could be split in two. So the first of that was interest rates obviously rallied pretty hard. So for those who were long duration, probably did pretty well out of that. We started this year facing the wrong way. We were pretty positive to start this year, and then we had to turn that around pretty quickly, and we ended up doing okay out of that. The other thing that I think is the memorable thing that sits in my mind is just how ballistic credit has performed through this period. So, you know, you're in this recession, you're in harsh economic times, and corporates are now pricing tighter than when they started this year. And that to me is probably the most head-scratching thing. I get that there's a lot of quantitative easing, there's a lot of support, there's a lot of fiscal support, but that's the thing that you look at and you go, wow, that's really not what we would have forecasted to start this year.
Yeah, I think for me, the really big thing has been the amount of central bank intervention in markets. You know, you look back over the last 10 years and you think, is there really more that they can do? And they keep pulling out new policies and new ways of doing things, not, you know, very healthy for markets probably in the long run, but I guess, you know, That's their mode of operation now, and they'll do everything it takes to make sure we don't have a bad outcome. But yeah, I think you know, the credit story and equities more broadly probably relates to the big end of town versus the little guys. You know, big corporations had a lot of support and a lot of ability to ride through the crisis. Most of the impact is probably at the smaller end of town, small business, you know, sole traders, people like that. And that really isn't the part of the world or the part of the economy that financial markets capture.
Yeah, and I think you're kind of still seeing that in the economic information. There's still signs that small businesses are firing people. There's still questions about the solvency of some of these small businesses. You know, they don't get access to the same sort of credit and banking facilities that the big corporates do. And so I think, you know, when you look at the crisis and what's going on, there still is the potential for the start of next year to see a little bit of pain in that JobKeeper ends, and those small businesses need to make real decisions because the government's not footing your bill. But, you know, we've been worrying about that for 6 months now, and it doesn't seem like the market really wants to bother too much with that idea at the moment.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, while the liquidity flows from the central banks and while, you know, the big end of town still has good access to cheap funding, there's no reason why that should suddenly stop. And I guess that sort of is a good segue into, you know, our outlook for 2021. You know, one of the things we probably realize is what drove performance this year is probably not going to be the same as what drives performance in 2021. We've pretty much got interest rates at zero. We've got credit spreads at the tightest levels that they've been even prior to the GFC. You know, when you look around at fixed income, you know, it's really going to be a very different environment to any we've seen for quite some time.
Yeah, I think as well, though, you know, I've started kind of looking at the outlook for 2021 pretty closely now, and there does seem to be some more positives than we probably would have thought 3 months ago. So, you know, obviously that vaccine news is very positive. If they're able to start rolling vaccines out early next year, then that's probably going to be seen as good for the market, and the potential to get the economy open next year would be very positive. But I think the other area that is obviously looking better is as well housing. That's proven to be extremely interest rate sensitive, and that's starting to pick up again, which is again I guess, good for retail and those types of things for the economy. So there are now starting to be a few things that you look at and say, okay, well, I can see the other side of this. I think, though, that you just need to be cognizant when you're looking at those good things to weigh up the fact that there has been a lot of government stimulus. So how positive you get will also depend on how quickly you expect that to be pulled away. And also the question mark around what some of this COVID virus stuff mean. So while I think it is correct to start leaning into a more positive stance for next year, there are still some questions I think that need to be answered.
Yeah, I guess that's really been the picture of really the last 5 years or even maybe 10 years is that we get green shoots, we see a little bit of growth momentum, and then as things start to tighten, conditions get worse or whatever else, the economy just seems to die. And to me, that's probably the biggest risk, probably more towards the end of 2021. Central banks have been very adamant that they will not withdraw stimulus too quickly. But you and I both know that central banks love to talk the talk and then sort of walk away from things very quickly if they think it's getting out of control. And I think that's going to be one of the really big tests for not just the RBA, but the Fed and other central banks is to be able to say, okay, if we withdraw stimulus too quickly, we're just going to kill this thing dead and to actually sit back and let things run. Because obviously with the 1970s experience of raging inflation and all those kinds of things that we saw back then, they're very, very worried because the entire central banking mantra really comes from that period of time. And I think, you know, to me, I'm still not convinced that they'll let it go that easily.
Yeah, I think that's correct. The RBA obviously today came out and said that they're going to leave cash at zero for at least 3 years. Well, that's what they're thinking. And so I think the important point when I look at what they're saying is they're telling us they're going to leave cash at zero. They're not necessarily saying they're going to do QE and yield curve control and everything else for 3 years. So there is a little bit of, you know, slippage, I guess, for them. If things do look more positive, they can say, look, we said we're going to leave cash here. We didn't say we're going to do this forever. So that's something that's certainly sitting in the back of my mind at the moment. But I think for the time being, at least the next kind of 3 to 6 months, they're going to be running these policies pretty aggressively.
Yeah, I mean, on balance, it definitely looks like a much better story than we could have probably hoped for, you know, earlier this year. And so much is really going to depend on the vaccine or whichever vaccine we end up with. We seem to have multiple ones now that are looking promising, but there's still some pretty big unanswered questions in that area. One is, you know, can they distribute it fast enough? You know, some of them require some fairly advanced storage facilities to be able to get them out, which is going to be problematic in parts of the world where they won't have that technology. The other question is we don't know dosage and things like that. They're still trying to work out those kinds of things. We don't know if there are any long-term side effects from the virus, and we just don't know whether people are going to step up and take it. I mean, there will always be some uptake, but the big question is, will that uptake be big enough to create enough protection that people can feel safe to start traveling again, which is really, you know, for a country like Australia, we need people to travel to sort of get our economy really back on track.
Yeah, I think that travel point is obviously an interesting one as well, because obviously the rich nations are lining up pretty quickly to get their hands on the first doses, but it's not quite obvious kind of the more developing nations how quickly those vaccines could be rolled out there. So maybe we'll be kind of become more reliant on the developed nations in terms of travel and those types of things. When I look at this from my perspective, I kind of think, would I want to be the first person to line up and take these COVID vaccines, knowing that the time period that it's taken to get this to the market is probably far faster than not only would you expect, but you would probably expect from the development of a vaccine that has the proper time to take place. So what are the long-term side effects is the question you asked. So I think there will be a group of people that say, I like the idea of a vaccine, I just don't want to be the first person to try it. And if that's what we see, then potentially there is the risk that it's not quite taken up as quickly as the market expects. And, you know, the recovery that we're kind of talking about in some of the figures and the potential for next year gets delayed a little bit into the back end of 2021. And so that's the real risk that I think could come from this.
Yeah. And I mean, at the moment, the virus is raging through Europe, parts of Asia, and certainly the US still. It's whether the economies there can cope for the next couple of weeks, you know, with emergency rooms and things like that already starting to get under stress even before the vaccine comes out. And I guess for Australians, winter is going to be a really big test. If we get the vaccine widely distributed and people taking it before winter, we probably will have a fairly good outcome, which will help the economy over the next 6 to 12 months. But if we don't get that vaccine in time, or it's not widely taken up, we run the same risk that's happened in the US and the Northern Hemisphere of a second wave again. And, you know, I don't think people are thinking along those lines at this moment. They're just thinking, yay, we've got a vaccine, it's all good. And so, you know, that has implications for consumer behavior and other kinds of things. And it certainly has a big impact on the recovery in the jobs market, which is probably, you know, equally as important as getting tourists back in the country. So, Chris, one of the other things that's obviously very topical and something that I think we've finally got the answer is to just how interest rate sensitive housing is in Australia. What's the outlook for housing, given we were probably on the more bearish end of expectations at the beginning of the year? And what are your expectations now looking through 2021 and into 2022?
Yeah, so kind of halfway through this year, when we were looking at all the factors that kind of drive housing, there were quite a lot of things that were pretty concerning. So, you know, you can run off a laundry list of the things that didn't look great for housing. So there was no population growth, high unemployment, there was wage freezes, deferred loans, there was a lot of uncertainty. There was all these things that typically you think of and say, this shouldn't be great for housing prices. Offsetting that though, we were very cognizant of the fact that interest rates generally do drive housing higher. So we were trying to balance those two things together and ended up saying, look, these negatives are really outweighing the positive of rates at the moment. At the moment though, when you look at it, interest rates have really won that war. So when I look at what's going on at the moment, there's really kind of two ideas that I'm kind of now thinking about for the housing market going forward. The first thing that kind of really jumps out of me at the moment is I don't really want to hear the argument being told to me that low rates don't work and that they're a waste of time. That just looks like utter garbage in this environment. The fall in interest rates have shown they've been as strong as ever in driving house prices higher and really making sure people have been spending through this period. So to look at this and say, oh, interest rates aren't doing anything, I think this has really solved that problem, because you can, as I said, run off a huge laundry list of negatives and those have just been overwhelmed. The second thing that's worth pointing out, I think, is that the RBA research that was put out in 2019 said that a 1% drop in interest rates would lead to a 16% increase in house prices, all else being equal, is how they described it. So if we kind of come through this crisis and we've got a vaccine, unemployment doesn't quite spike as high as we expected, then I think that the next 18 months are going to be pretty strong for housing. You know, interest rates have fallen by about 1.25% over the past kind of 6 to 12 months, which from RBA research would probably put an increase at about 15 to 20%. I like to calculate household debt coverage ratios. That as well is pointing to about a 15% increase in debt levels could be serviced due to the lower interest rates. So I think as long as we kind of don't hit a second wave and the economy comes through this okay, you should really be thinking about kind of 10, 20% house price increases over the next 18 months, because interest rates are hit rock bottom and we can really see how strong that is now.
To me, the really big difference this time around compared to perhaps what we've seen in other recessions was the amount of support that the government provided to the banking system and effectively co-opted the banking system into not foreclosing on people that weren't paying their mortgage. I think when we first sort of looked at our initial assessment, we were expecting some forced sales. We were expecting that there would be, you know, properties coming onto the market at a time when people weren't really looking to buy. We were probably wrong on that factor. The minute they dropped interest rates, everyone seemed to have wanted to buy, but we also never got the bad debt. We never got the forced sales come through because of the additional work that the government did in providing low-cost financing for the banks and asking the banks to be sensible about their approach to handling in arrears and in trouble loans. And I think, you know, more than anything, that's probably been, you know, equally as good a outcome as what the lower interest rates have been. So, you know, I guess that's one thing you really need to tip your hat to the government and say, you know, it was a really good policy at the time that worked quite well.
Yeah, I think as well, not only that, but JobKeeper and JobSeeker plays in there as well in the amount of spending was kind of sitting perfect on being able to meet all your payments. The thing that I kind of think about at the moment, and as you know, I kind of worry about most things, is that if housing prices do run 20% here, we're going to see household debt increase again across Australia. We've already got the second highest household debt levels in the world. And if that's going to increase more, it's the chance that it's going to become the highest. My feeling is that in kind of 18, 24 months time, we're going to be looking at interest rates and just looking at that housing debt load and saying, wow, how the hell do we get out of this? Because we've always tried to solve our economic problems by pushing house prices higher. That's kind of not really something that you'd worry about over the next 6 to 12 months, but it is something I could certainly see us looking at in kind of 18 to 24 months time.
Sure. And that leads to sort of another thing is it's been a big theme, we think, for the next couple of years, and something that's going to be a problem for, you know, the Western world in particular, is the issue of inequality. The one thing we've seen with COVID-19 is that the impact is not being proportionally borne across the entire population. It certainly hurt younger people a lot more, because those are the sorts of jobs that were easily shed quickly, and many of them wouldn't have been in work long enough to have got JobKeeper. And the other thing is too, you know, the more house prices go up, the harder it is for new entrants into that market. So, you know, inequality is getting worse probably from this, probably not to the stage of what it is in the US, but we can already see some of the social problems that are creeping up in the US from, you know, that existing situation. And we've also, on top of that, we've had share prices now at records as well, which again, if you don't have a lot of super and things like that, you've probably missed out on that leg up as well. What do you think inequality is going to do, and will it impact our ability to come out of this this crisis?
The past 10 years, I think, tells us that QE, low interest rates, those types of policies, it just drives inequality. You can look basically anywhere across the world and it seems to be getting worse. When I kind of think about the outcomes in Australia, you know, you look at housing, as you mentioned, if you're age 20 to 35, only about 1/3 of people own property in that age group. So if you push house prices up another 20%, it's going to be very hard for those people to get into that market, which has been the way typically Australians have built wealth. I think there's kind of two ways that you can think about how this could affect outcomes. So the first is obviously the political outcomes. You know, you look in the US where there's far bigger inequality than here, and their political outcomes seem to be getting really divided. The riots and the protests and the different kind of areas between the Republicans and the Democrats, that really showed that, you know, inequality is driving some far kind of divergent thinking over there. I think, though, the other place that you'll potentially see this out is in government policy trying to make certain areas more affordable. So in New Zealand, for example, you're already seeing them starting to talk about macroprudential rules on housing. Australia did that in 2016, and that really slowed house prices down here. It really killed the investor market. I kind of think there probably won't be any kind of sudden changes from this, but you roll kind of 12 months forward and the government might need to start thinking about policies to make housing more affordable for young people. And they also might need to be wary of divided political outcomes, because those people that haven't done well through this period are probably going to be looking for something else.
So Chris, inflation's something that we think long and hard about. Interest rates are telling us one thing, but we're starting to see commodity prices take off, which is generally telling us something completely different. Can you give us some idea of what you think that divergence is coming from, and does it have implications for our outlook in 2021?
Yeah, so the commodity prices are actually a little bit mixed when I went and kind of looked through what they're showing at the moment. So copper, iron ore, those types of commodities, they're actually at the highest level since 2014. So they're really starting to rip and point to a global growth story. Oil is back to about where it was late last year. And you're also kind of starting to see some agricultural commodities lift as well. Now, when you put all of that together, the Bloomberg Commodity Index is actually still down about 3% year on year, but it's really off its lows. And as I said, you know, those kind of copper and iron ore style commodities are really starting to run. Now, typically when you get commodities running like that, it creates an inflationary cycle. So when I think about the environment at the moment, there are potentially kind of two things that were telling me that inflation was going to be low. That was the housing sector was struggling. We know rents are falling and those types of things. And commodity prices had been falling up until kind of the past 2 months. If both housing and commodity prices can lift over the next 12 months, that to me kind of says that there's a risk of an inflationary spike coming sometime late next year. And I think that really goes back to kind of what you're describing with the RBA and the Fed. If commodities and housing are up and inflation spikes late next year, you know, whether it's say 3%, 4%, something like that, not kind of wildly high, but just enough to kind of raise your eyebrows at it, will the RBA kind of decide enough's enough, we need to slow down here? So the commodity prices at the moment, as I said, the Bloomberg Commodity Index is still down 3% year on year. But if that kind of continues its momentum, I think the inflation story will be looking better than we had have expected for next year.
I would temper that with just the fact that unless we see some kind of wage inflation, it's highly unlikely that consumer prices are going to get out of control. And to me, that's probably the bigger question. But, you know, we haven't seen wage rises now for anybody above much of more than 2% in Australia for many, many years now. It's obviously a policy of the RBA to get that up. But I think, you know, personally, without some sort of wage inflation, overall consumer inflation is not going anywhere.
I think that's also important to kind of point out on why we're talking about whether or not the RBA can kind of handle these types of things or think about these types of things, because a spike in commodity prices would be a 1 year increase in inflation. You would need to see the wages running for that to be kind of sustained over a number of years. So I'm kind of not expecting to say this is going to be an inflationary cycle for 5 years. I think the commodity price story could be a 1 year story. And then the question just becomes, do they overreact to it? Or are the central banks kind of backing their policies over time and saying that we're going to let inflation run here so that we can kind of offset the deflationary world that we've been in for the past 5 years?
I guess time will tell. more questions than answers as always. So that's it from us for 2020. Been a big year, certainly one that, as I said, none of us will forget. Like the RBA, we'll be taking a break in January and we'll be back for the first meeting in 2021 in February. So I'd just like to wish all our listeners a happy holiday period and hope that you manage to get some respite from the doom and gloom for a little bit, and we'll see you all in 2021.
This podcast was prepared by Nikko AM Limited, ABN 9900337652, AFSL number 237563. It is of a general nature only and does not constitute personal advice or an offer of any financial product. It does not take into account the objectors' financial situation or needs of any individual. Any references to particular securities or sectors are for illustrative purposes only, and this is not a recommendation. Any economic or market forecasts are not guaranteed.